Hello and welcome to Lot of Them Movies 33, The Lincoln Lawyer. How's it going, Andrew?
It's going fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm great. So, wasn't this a Patreon name, right?
I think it was. It was definitely a Patreon suggestion, and thanks, guys. I don't know. Well, it's funny.
When I saw that Patreon name, I was like, well, I was thinking this was going to be like a Dinesh D'Souza. You know, I'm thinking Lincoln. He's really into Lincoln. Yeah. You know, it's probably going to be some stupid thing about how Dinesh D'Souza was actually, because he was a Republican and therefore believed in today's current Republican ideals. I thought it would be something like that, you know, like one of those. Yeah,
I will tell you, like, I had to watch the movie all the way through before I realized, like, oh, they call it the Lincoln Lawyer because he's right surrounded a Lincoln.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
I was like waiting
gimmick.
For it to be. I'm like, is that a $5 bill joke or something?
It could be. Yeah,
well,
this is
Matthew
a weird.
He bribes
thing.
A lot of people. In
he bribes
this movie,
a lot
so.
Of people. He's a grifter, and what amazes me about Matthew McConaughey in this movie is so many things, but his character is a grifter. Who takes the time to both make hundreds of thousands of dollars, but also grift people out of like a couple $100 at a time? It's just amazing.
We're gonna talk so much of this movie. It's kind of like you made this either you or I think it was
a
Mark
dream
from
of me that you had. Oh no!
Well, it could have been that too. But I'm thinking actually it was Mark from How to Heretic. But one of the two of you when we did Body
the Madonna
of Evidence,
one, right? Yeah,
the Madonna movie, and one of you pointed out like there are 937 lit candles in the scene. So like if you think about this for a second, you have to imagine that like Madonna spent 3 hours lighting all the right. And it was just one of those like great movie moments where you're like, yeah, this looks fine. But as soon as you think about this for a second, you're like, that's totally fucking stupid. And I think like that's the metaphor for this movie. Like everything is fine up until you engage your brain for like a tenth of a second and then you're like, what's going on?
If you are not a lawyer, which I you know some people aren't, I think
really?
this movie is not bad. I actually think it's not too bad. It's got some good stuff. It's a nice tension. It's just honestly, it's just like the other fucking ones we do all the time with Sam. You know, like it's that maybe slightly better tension. You know, here and there, just as probably stupid law wise, but like it's a good thriller. You know, but then when you think about it, it's like, oh, this is real bad. doesn't make any sense.
I think that's right, but I guess for me the problem is like I can take a like popcorn movie. You know, I am be like, okay, you know, disengage your brain, kind of put it on in the background, or you know, even you're watching it intently, but like, you know, you're not supposed to think too hard about it. But like the movie wants to also be a cerebral thriller. So like that's where I get the biggest kind of cognitive dissonance from it. But I have to ask you this question. So the Lincoln Lawyer is I don't even know what his name is. He's Matthew McConaughey.
It's Matthew McConaughey.
What are your thoughts on Matthew McConaughey?
Well, first off, he disappears into the role so thoroughly that I didn't even know it was Matthew McConaughey. Oh, no, never mind. That's nonsense. You always instantly know it's Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
There's some lawyers where you're like, oh, or some lawyers. Yeah, that was some funny. There's some actors where you're like, oh, yeah, he was also that guy in this movie. And then there's some where it's like, that's Tom Cruise. That's Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, like, they're just that. And Matthew McConaughey, I love to just sit there and watch what's happening with Matthew McConaughey. I don't know if I could say I'm a fan, but I just, okay. Did you watch True Detective, the season one that he was in? Cause that was really good.
No,
I love that one. that season.
I could imagine. So I'll put my cards on the table, and you know, patrons can send the hate mail to me or whatever. I really don't like Matthew McConaughey, right? Like, and I could imagine him being good, right? Like, I think the Tom Cruise comparison is right? Like, so for example, like, Tom Cruise always plays Tom Cruise, and when Tom Cruise is playing Tom Cruise in The Color of Money, like, he's amazing, right? When he's playing Tom Cruise in The Firm, like, he's less.
He's also amazing. I get your point. Yeah. Constantly amazing. I like Tom Cruise more than I like Matthew McConaughey. I think Matthew McConaughey. No, I guess what I was going to say before you so rudely interrupted me. No. tables of
Thomas, can you just let me speak here? I mean, this
God,
is really.
Can I finally, Andrew, can I get a word out? I like watching Matthew McConaughey the same way I like watching like a magician, which is to say I'm not really that into magic. But I like when you're so, when you
Lot Awful Movies 33, fuck you Eli Bosch.
Pretty much. But I would love to watch Eli do his thing all day, because the whole time I'm just thinking, look at Eli doing his thing. Like, there's never a moment when I'm in it. There's never a moment when I'm like, is there really spirit, which, you know, cuz I'm an adult. I get it, you know. But like, Even as an adult, I'm never like, oh, look at the trick. I'm always just like, oh, look at what he's doing there. This is how he's doing this. This is great. That's awesome. And I like it. And I like Eli a lot better than I like Matthew McConaughey. But Matthew McConaughey's whole magic act is being like, I am a man who is interesting. Like, that's his whole, I don't know how else to put it. Like, his entire, everything about him, the way he looks around, the way he talks, the way he acts, the way he walks, the way, like, you know, fidgets with stuff, just every single thing is like, he could do all that, all that stuff, all the movement, all the everything he's doing, and then he could be like, so anyway, what's the movie I'm in, what's the scene, what's the script? You know, like, it has nothing to do with anything other than, my name's Matthew McConaughey, I'm going to look like I'm a really interesting, like, cerebral, brilliant but complicated man, you know what I mean? And he's so good at that shtick that I kind of admire it, even though I don't really like watching him very much. As just an actor. Does that make sense?
I can accept that. I think that I'm with you on that one, and I'm gonna give him more of a chance. Is it Lincoln that he does car commercials for? Because those
I know
whatever car
that's
he
this
does,
it's all oh, just God. The origin story for those commercials. that's all this is.
It makes those make more sense, but man, they still piss me off. So.
Yeah, because it's just that. It's the same thing. It's like, look at this man who is interesting and thinky and intense, and like, that's it. Like, he would just do that no matter what. The character, the word, the script, that's all. Yeah, I'll get to that. But like, first off, this is the thing I'm doing. And so we watched Driving Miss Daisy. No, we watched The Lincoln. So it's The Lincoln Lawyer. Sorry, that's The Lincoln Lawyer. This is the overall thing is so funny, because I was pretty sure just based on watching this, and then I checked to make sure I was right. This seemed like a book or a series, you know, or something, because it's a gimmick. Like, oh, this is this character. His gimmick is that he doesn't really apparently have an office that he practices out of. He has a car. But then the thing about the movie, which often happens with movies, is they only have time to really briefly do that particular bit any justice, you know? So it's like they set that up for like 5 minutes. Like, oh, your office is dirty. Oh, the maid's coming, you know, later. But it doesn't really matter at all. Like, it never factors in. He could have just been, they could have written this fucking movie, and he could have just had a law office, and it would all be exactly the same. Like, literally nothing depends on it.
Yes, that is exactly right. It's just like they want him to be colorful. And of course, it create like one of the recurring comments that I often make on Law and Awful Movies that is just out in full force in this movie is that, like, movies and TV shows and all forms of media, I suppose books, I don't really read law fiction, like, seem to have no idea how lawyers get paid, right? Like,
envelopes of cash from biker gangs.
Well, not just that, but like, so you start doing the math in this movie, and you're like, at because they want to simultaneously be like, yeah, well, here, he, you know, he's making all this money.
He's got to save the $1,100 rent on an office is the thing.
So he's like simultaneously like really wealthy, but also like represents low lifes and has to like chisel and
they
cheat
can
out
never
every
make
$200.
Up their mind.
It's nuts. It's just nuts. So, but maybe we should get started on the actual movie, or you and I could just riff on Matthew McConaughey for, you know, 90 minutes. That
no, but
too.
I do. That was one of the things I picked up too about this movie was. It really has no idea whether he's a good, successful lawyer or like a, you know, a Better Call Saul kind of lawyer. It's somewhere in between. It's funny. Like, I just love hustle. Like, he's hustling for hundreds of thousands. And then he's also like bilking a schoolgirl out of her lemonade stand money at the same time. You know, it's great.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. And I really thought I'm 100% with you. And now we move. But like that. It in the beginning, it was sort of playing like he's just terrible at his job and is trying to hustle his way into it. But then it's like somebody else wrote the second half of the movie. I still don't know. So,
yeah.
But let's get this show.
But one thing we can all agree on is that it definitely gets attorney client privilege 100% correct. Just like every movie we ever do. More on that
like
later.
That.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Well, take it away, sir. Where do we start with a lot of walk and talk and walk and talk. That's how you have to start.
Oh, yeah.
Any...
Well, also, we start with, I want to say this, like, I know this is a 2011 movie, so like I get a lot of flack based on my musical preferences, which were carved into stone in 1989.
Yeah.
But I like them. I like all the even the hip hop style. Like I like all the music in this movie. It bears no relationship to what's going on. On the screen whatsoever. It's like all kind of poppy and upbeat. And so we begin with the credits with a song called Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City. And I'm like, oh man, this is awesome. And it's fantastic. And then we get Matthew McConaughey, who's Matthew McConaughey, the lawyer, who is working, trying to find out information. We sort of see him doing kind of, you know, shady law stuff. So he's trying to pump information from the bailiff, whose name is Rinaldo, and he calls him, you know, Roberto. And so, you know, because it's kind of funny that that Matthew McConaughey is a racist, I guess. And then we get an actor whom I dislike almost as much as Matthew McConaughey. We get John Leguizamo on to
really?
Do some
Why
bits.
Do you not like John Leguizamo? By the way, his character name in this, I think, is Red Herring. He's my favorite red herring ultimately because it makes no sense one way or the other. Like he just like is the bad guy, but then he's not the bad guy. But then there's no reason why he wasn't the bad guy other than we wanted to go with a different red herring. Like that we want. It's one of those where it's like we just want you to be confused and not know what's about to happen. That's it. We're not going to put any work into it. That's just what we want to have happen.
Yeah, it's example number one of many, many, many of don't think too hard about this. But yeah, so we'll call him Senor Rojo from now on because he is definitely I love him as red herring. Can I do the flip side? Like we're going to introduce like some crazy great actors, right? Like Marissa Tomei and Bryan Cranston and William H. motherfucking Macy, who may be the best of them all. Like he's so great.
Yeah. But why don't you like John Leguizamo? I don't remember.
There's a line in here that I think it just feels like he's kind of trying to shoehorn his like stand-up comedy bits into every role I've seen him in. So we're doing shtick. Okay. All right. Well, fair. It just sort of takes me out of the. So it's not like if John Leguizamo wants to start listening, you know, to the show.
Then you're his biggest fan. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm happy to have this conversation with him a little, but I feel like he's doing shtick a lot. So, we get to see more of McConaughey's character. He's at an arraignment and. his client hasn't paid him, and yeah. and we get we get some actual good law here, because that I thought was going to go the other way, but it turns out to be good law where McConaughey says, I don't work if you don't pay me. And yeah. the first time through, like I took down notes of like, nope, doesn't work that way. But the movie knows it doesn't work.
Yeah, I right? noticed that like, too.
Yeah, yeah. The
client and then the movie said, you know what a lawyer would do with a client who's like, ha, you can't just quit because law says you can't just quit, is he would make up a fake witness called Mr. Green. Get it? He tells the judge, oh, we need more time. He's delaying to make sure his client plays him. Or pays him, and the judge says, oh, what do you need more time for? Oh, we need to track down a witness named Mr. Green. Get it? Because money is the
yep thing. and look, like, again, no lawyer would do this because your client would file a bar complaint from you from prison, and that would be taken very, very seriously. But other than that, right?
Yeah.
Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play? Other than that, like it's kind of correct, right? In the sense that lawyers are definitely not happy when they don't get paid. They're definitely prohibited from withdrawing from representation just because they can't get paid. If your client is being held on pretrial detention and the defense attorney asks for a continuance in the case, right? The prosecution's perfectly happy to grant that, right? Because
yeah, 'cause he's
the guy
just sitting,
is still locked
yeah,
up. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So, you know, so that's so that scene, it's like plus 3 points for those, and then, you know, minus several thousand for the like
everything else.
Like I just don't get the for Matthew McConaughey being like, well, this is how I'm really going to stick it to my client. Like, you know, you wouldn't do that. And it's weird because I like moral ambiguity in movies a lot. But like I just feel like throughout this entire movie, you're like, no, Matthew McConaughey is just a scumbag. Right. Like it's not like he's a tragically flawed character. He's just horrible. So yeah.
Well, like you say, for part of it, and then he's a saint for the rest of it. I don't know. Right. I can't decide.
For no reason. Yeah.
Yeah. But I love it. So then he drives away in his office, right? And
yeah.
And then wouldn't you know it, there's a motorcycle gang, and that turns out that they were there like part. That's what the client was from that didn't pay. So it's a motorcycle gang with all kinds of drug money. And yet they can't pay the lawyer enough for the they're all over the place, this motorcycle gang.
They're
murderers and drug dealers, but with hearts of gold, I think, is the answer. Maybe.
Well, and that seems to be a theme in this movie.
Yeah.
But there's also an annoying bit, right? Because this movie will invoke the question of, you know, just having a third party present break attorney-client privilege.
Yeah.
There's this stupid, annoying bit. So McConaughey gets into his office. He's got a chauffeur in the front, and it's a cross between a 25-year-old Morgan Freeman and Argyle why am I blanking on Die Hard? Right?
So, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's,
so he's like halfway in between.
Yeah.
But, you know, sassy young black chauffeur for reasons, despite the fact that this, you know, it's 2011. And so he says earmuffs, right? Like, you know, like Argyle is an 8-year-old child. And you're supposed to get the idea that way he doesn't overhear the attorney-client mm-hmm. privilege stuff. But look, like office staff doesn't break attorney-client yeah. privilege. Yeah. So anyway, so that's annoying. The bikers are like, pull over. And then and you think like, ooh, is he going to get. But no, you learn that they're a drug dealing biker gang and he represents them. And he shakes him down for another $5,000. And you realize that like it's to fly in a fake expert witness. And then.
Yeah.
They.
Because you want to definitely shake down the murder biker gang for another couple $1,000. That's worth lying to them about. The expert that you don't actually have to fly in. Like, what?
Yeah. And And look, like, this is also really, really scumbag bad behavior by McConaughey, right? Like, it's not funny to be like, oh, I'm spending this money on a witness. Ha ha. I mean, I'm just pocketing it. Like, that is, as we've talked about, the one thing that will definitely get you disbarred.
And am I crazy? And tell me if I'm wrong here, but they sort of messed up the amounts a little bit. Like, they gave him $5,000 in the year 1990 to protect this client. And they're like, that should still be good. And he's like, well, no, you got to pay me more because I'm like $5,000. That's nothing, right? I mean, nobody could have thought that was going to last the entire trial.
Yeah, no. And you see him ask when he's got the rich client for $100,000 to go through trial, which, you know, is more in line with what it would actually cost. It's just another example of like the film's economics kind of all going out of whack. Because look, like, if he has one wealthy client who pays him the $100,000 and then like a handful of these like $5,000 client, like, we can all do the math.
He's
going
to risk
right?
like, his fucking life by trying to scam the biker gang out of another $5,000. Oh, it's so dumb.
And again, we could do the math on that. Like, those don't add up to the million-dollar lifestyle that he's leading. But, any event.
Well, he's not. You think he's leading a million-dollar lifestyle?
Well, he's got the chauffeured car.
Well, but that's just that. I don't think that costs that much money. He's got a car, sure, but that's his office. And then a chauffeur he pays.
That's true, but I'm pretty sure it's more expensive. And then later, when you see his chauffeur,
when you see his house, he lives in a dump.
Well, so. That's true. That's a fair point. All right, I rescind that.
I think the book. I bet you the book is like he's barely scraping by, and that's why he's. I bet you anything. It must be that. But where does the
chauffeur come from? Then is that like it? Just
how much do you think it is? It's like that's practically an Uber driver. Do you think that's a lot of money? To have a guy drive your car?
Pre-Uber, like having a chauffeur was that's the sign that they use in the movie for like the rich guy, right? I don't know. Anyway, okay. maybe I'm reading the movie wrong way.
You think he pays the chauffeur more than he would pay a paralegal or whatever? Like it's probably, he doesn't seem to have any other. Oh no, I guess he has like one other assistant. Anyway, so with the important point is new client, Ryan Phillippe or whatever his name is. I don't know.
He's one of those actors like I kind of recognize, right. But I don't know what I recognize him from.
I had the same experience. I was like, oh, I know that name. So I'm going to Google him and then it'll be like, oh, he's from all the stuff. And then I looked at the stuff he's in. I'm like, oh, I don't really know this guy, actually. I just know that name somehow.
Yeah. But he is the one. So he's been John Leguizamo has steered this guy to our protagonist, Matthew McConaughey, because he's been charged with assault the charges actually change throughout the again. Sorry, but like he's beaten up this girl really, really badly.
Right.
And so we get to meet the family lawyer and we get to meet the, you know, overbearing rich mom and, you know, and it's just kind of driving home like, okay, this guy is super wealthy. And so, you know, that's how Matthew McConaughey, like who 2-bit scam artist, is really, really going to scam the hell out of these guys.
I found this I was very confused. I didn't know. So this actor, Bob Gunton or whatever, who plays the lawyer, I thought that was his dad because I didn't understand. Because he's like a high-powered attorney, right? He's got this big law firm. And also, side note, that guy, that actor's from a bunch of stuff, including, in his credits, a show called Trial and Error that now we have to do for a lot of movies. Trial and Error looks like it was in 2017. So, wait, we didn't already do it, did we? No, I'm sure we can.
No.
Okay, yeah, well, we got to do that because it's just the name alone means we need to cover it. But I was very confused. So I guess he's a high-powered attorney that they already had, but then the Ryan Phillippe or whatever specifically asked for Matthew McConaughey. I'm getting really confused with names. Sorry. But for our main character, Matthew McConaughey, specifically asked for him, which it's confusing and ominous, right? I wonder if there's a reason specifically asked
no,
for.
Nope, definitely not.
Not a reason.
We can end
just
the movie now.
Yeah, no,
I always interpreted old lawyer guy as like the because we don't understand how you know how definitely not the bad guy suspect is like how his family has made the money.
Turns out to be real estate.
Yeah, I mean, but we learned he works as a realtor, which I don't know. Like it doesn't scream Donald Trump and Eric Trump to me. But whatever. But so the lawyer I just interpreted as like this is the civil lawyer, and while they have a full service firm, you know, they're going to go outside and hire Matthew McConaughey to handle the street crime that they don't typically.
I see.
Deal with that was always my interpretation, and then we get a smash cut over to the DA's office where we get Marissa Tomei, who's
so great.
Marissa Tomei, and no, she's wonderful. Like
I just like watching Marissa Tomei and stuff. I'll be honest, it's just fun.
Me
she's,
too.
She's good. She's fun to watch. I love it.
It and you don't watch the Marvel movies, so nah, they cast her as Aunt. They cast her as Aunt May in the new Spider-Man.
I didn't see that.
Which is great. Yeah, it's a kind of a weird because like in the comics, Aunt May was always like,
was like
100 years old.
Yeah, old lady.
And like, yeah, and so now she's.
I was doing
like,
the math. I was like, this is 2011. How old could she be?
Yeah, no, it's fun, right? Because so comics like Aunt May is like 107 and Peter Parker is 18 and no one was ever like, well, that seems weird. So in the movies, like it's Marissa Tomei and she's supposed to be like, you know, actual Marissa Tomei.
We
like
barely have time to do riffs on this movie, much less.
Oh,
go
I'm
into
sorry.
The details,
but anyway, so she's like Spider-Man. Hot older lady. It's really cool. Anyway, so there's just a little bit of like, hi, I'm Marissa Tomei and I'm going to have like 12 cameos in this movie for no reason. Then we smash cut back over to the bail hearing. We get to see the beginning of Matthew McConaughey working his magic where the DA wants to hold scumbag McScummison without bail because of the severity of the crime. And Matthew McConaughey is like, look, he's got no priors. He's not a flight risk. The judge volunteers ankle bracelet, which is something that your defense attorney would do. But again, this kind of plays out the way it would in real life, right? Like,
yeah,
Funny thing was, I had to
watch this movie in two parts, you know, because I'm all over the place. So I watched the first, maybe not quite half, and I was like, well, you know, the law is not so bad. And then, like, when I right where I stopped it was like apparently the meridian or whatever for where the law turns to total garbage. And so when I unpaused it to continue it, I was like, oh my god, what happened? What while I was gone, the law went to shit. It's right around minute like 45, I'd say.
Well, there's some shitty law coming up here too.
Oh, so, okay. Well, yeah, of course. But yeah, relatively speaking, is what I mean, of course.
But yeah, and then as they're walking out of the courthouse, he's like, "Uh-oh, the press is already on to us," and you have a guy who's a freelance journalist.
I saw this coming a mile away, by the way.
Well, yeah, because they haven't dropped enough hints about how Matthew McConaughey is a scumbag. The journalist has a like 1985 camcorder slung on his shoulder. He uses VHS tapes, right? Like I don't even know in 2011 where they got this. But
if anyone watches it, it's not a VHS tape, but it's some sort of like still a tapey looking thing. It's not.
Oh,
a thumb
it totally
drive.
Looked like a. It totally looked like a VHS cassette.
Well, it's
to me.
Like the smaller thing one. Anyway, the point is he's from the 80s and it actually makes sense because it's a total grift. And this is where I made the lemonade stand joke. He grifts the guy, the high powered attorney out of $1,000 for this footage. He's like, turns out he has a relationship with a cameraman or whatever, obviously, but he pretends, oh, who are you? Oh, you're going to sell this to the highest bidder, huh? Well, how about we buy it from you? And then you're thinking, even I was thinking at this point, I'm like, well, what is he going to pay him, like $20,000, you know, $10,000? No, he's like, well, normally I get paid $750 for it.
Dollars.
Oh, what a weird. He's got a dedication to grift is what I appreciate about
it. That's right. That's exactly how this movie plays our protagonist. And of course, the con you saw coming a million miles away was actually the cameraman is also a friend of Matthew McConaughey's, and they meet back up as he drives around to the other side of the courthouse, and he splits it 80-20 with the cameraman getting $200 and McConaughey pocketing another $800.
It's gas money for his office.
Yeah, our hero. Then we cut away to, and we've set up the big meeting at the high powered lawyer's office. I have this guy is not Victor Garber because I really wanted it to be Victor Garber.
Yeah, it could have been.
No, it's not. But right, that's the same kind of character that Victor Garber
always
plays.
I mean, I always want any character to be Victor Garber.
Right. Yeah, we love Victor Garber. we could just change this show to official
OA policy.
Yeah. I think. So they go
to... What the hell was going on here? I don't even understand this from the movie's perspective. From the movie's perspective, they're talking, and then he's like, well, the mom needs to leave or something? What was that?
So there's both good law and bad law in this scene. Him kicking the mom out is actually good law.
Okay. But what was the part where she tries to pay him?
Yeah, that's the bad law.
Yeah, that made no sense.
So we'll do both. Right. So it's Chekhov's mom here.
just to finish the sentence for the listeners, she tries to pay Matthew McConaughey, and Matthew McConaughey's like, tear that shit up. I only can be paid from your son because I'm your son's lawyer. And I was like, I don't think that's how that works. I'm pretty sure lawyers are like, anyone who wants to give me money, I will take it.
Absolutely. I say that speaking as representative of the law offices of P. Andrew Torres. No, look, like, of course somebody else can pay your legal fees on your behalf. Otherwise, you couldn't have insurance pay for when, you know, the director or officer of a company gets sued. Right? Like, I mean, that's just silly. But the kicking the mom out of the room is actually not silly because having an unrepresented party present, an unrepresented third party, breaks attorney-client privilege. With your family, it doesn't really matter except that – and I made this note and then watched it and it came out. It was one of the things I was really happy about. Unless you put the mom on the stand, which he does later on. So if you put a family member on the stand, one of the things that opposing counsel is very likely to do is to ask, have you ever been present in any conversations?
It's like one of those dirty lawyer tricks, huh?
Yeah, between your son and his lawyer. And if they say yes, then you're like, okay, I want records of all of that because that vitiates the privilege. Really great little moment there. Okay. Could have been accidental, but I liked it. Also slightly undercut by the fact that not Victor Garber is still in the room. And I guess you could write that around by saying that they've hired on the high powered law firm as co-counsel.
Yeah.
But they don't do that in the movie. So, you know, if we're,
and then, I mean, I think it all falls off the rails or goes off the rails or whatever. And again, correct me if I'm wrong. We get William H. Macy finally, which is great. I love that. He's like the private detective that's working for Matthew McConaughey. And he's like, well, I got a copy of the discovery file. And he's like, we were going to get it eventually, but this just saves us some time or gives us more of a heads up or something.
I get it early. So we get rabble, rabble, rabble. Don't think about this one too hard. Yeah. That was totally. And there's going to be a switcheroo.
Yeah. It gets even
also
worse.
totally fucking stupid about it. You don't need any of that. So that kind of went off the rails. And then, you know, we flash cut back over to the meeting in the law office that's still going on. And Matthew McConaughey does the one thing that nobody in his position would ever do, which is, all right, tell me what happened.
Right. Exactly.
Because as we've talked about many, many times, and this movie will get wrong, when you know your client has done the murder, you can't put your client on the stand, or the, in this case, the assault. You can't put your client on the stand and suborn perjury, right? If you know they're going to lie, you can't put them on the stand. You have to not know. And so lawyers deliberately will never ask it in that way. They will say, they will ask leading questions and will say, okay, I'm going to play the role of cross-examination here. But you would never just sort of be like, okay, well, you know, why don't you start narrating and and then we'll take it from here.
I got to point this out too. Weird bit of homophobia here. I'm glad it ended up being like it made sense in the end that the character was a homophobe, because in the beginning – I was trying to do the math. I was like, 2011, was this okay in 2011? I was trying to figure it out. And then it's like, oh, no, no, no. You were just signaling that he was the bad guy all along.
Yeah.
Furthermore,
yeah,
also,
I agree. Yeah, they use a slur. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
And it also turned out that, we'll talk about it later. But it did come back around. But it was so jarring that I had to do some calendar math. I was like, when was it? Was this 1971 or 2011? But it turns out it was just a really obvious signaling that he was the bad guy all along.
Yeah. And so in that event, then I liked it. And I wonder if it had, I hope that it did, right? This is 2011. I hope that it had the same sort of effect, you know, of the client, you know, using the slur for gay people. Not hard to imagine which one that is for gay men. Not hard to imagine which one that is. And like it really does kind of shock you. And so if that was done intentionally to shock you and to say like, yeah, that's how we know who the bad guy is now, then, you know, then I'm cool with it. So,
yeah. But I guess maybe it was in a time where it wouldn't have been quite as obvious as a signal of this is going to be the bad guy.
Yeah,
or
because yeah,
otherwise,
yeah, right.
It's kind of stupid. It's like him just saying I'm the bad guy before they want him to. Anyway, whatever. Turns out he's the bad guy, though.
Turns out, spoilers. So we get that. Then we get the debriefing after the meeting between Matthew McConaughey and William H. Macy at a bar, in which I realized at the end of this scene that Matthew McConaughey trying to act drunk is indistinguishable from Matthew McConaughey trying to act like an asshole, which is indistinguishable from Matthew McConaughey. So I was very, very befuddled by this scene. This is the first part where we learn another thing that the movie gets right, which is that Matthew McConaughey drinks an unbelievable quantity of alcohol throughout the movie, which is
if my complaint, look. I've always complained about this, and back in the day, I thought it was just because I wasn't experienced enough in my drinking. Now that I have all the drinking experience one might need out of life, I'm still complaining about this, because they do the thing where the guy pours himself about a liter and a half of whiskey and goes, you know, just dumps it down his gullet. And I just got to say, I don't think that's anybody's drinking habit. I really don't. Like, is there anybody... who does that? Like even a horrendously alcoholic lawyer like Andrew Torres or somebody, where it's like you're still going to pour a nice scotch and just drink a lot of it, but you're going to like enjoy it, right? Yeah, there's no need for the pouring like 40 ounces of whiskey and just like dumping it down your throat as fast as possible. Is that a lawyer behavior?
No, this is a full on
typical
like
hacky.
Gene Wilder, you know, kind of like drinking
it's
straight
so
from
weird.
The bottle in Blazing Saddles, kind of, you know, yeah. It's
like we have to signal that he's an alcoholic lawyer or whatever. Like, he can't just have a drink. He's got to pour it down his throat.
Yeah. And we get the other incredibly bizarre habit in this movie. I know our good friend Morgan Stringer is going to be listening to this. Maybe like all of these supposed abbreviations that Matthew McConaughey and his associates keep using, like, are crazy, right? Like, so Marissa Tomei comes in, she does one of her cameos here. She comes into the bar, and he's like, "That's an NG, baby," meaning, you got to have a not guilty verdict, but you know, it's kind of like 50% lawyer and 50% Dick Vitale. And you're like, what, like lawyers don't talk that way. I'm positive. There's never been a lawyer who's ever said that's an NG baby. Oh God. So, So Matthew McConaughey is drunk and Marissa Tomei has got to take him home. That whole scene was designed to tell us two things. Number one, there's still some sexual chemistry between Matthew McConaughey and Marissa Tomei. Because they're Matthew McConaughey and Marissa Tomei. Of course they're
married and divorced.
Yeah, yeah.
And have a kid together. So we find out all that.
And also to find out that Wonder Investigator William H. Macy has managed to secure the videotape from the bar.
Which the police didn't, by the way. The police didn't. The prosecution didn't have it. But he's got it.
We're about to learn that the prosecution is really the Washington Generals of attorneys.
Yeah,
here,
weirdest thing. Weirdest thing. So, and look, pretend the law is whatever you want it to be. There's a good tension here, which is, you know, dramatic tension kind of thing, which is McConaughey, they get this CD and they have the video and they're like, oh, well, here's what we determined. The victim was punched in her right eye and this other guy at the bar that they think was like, you know, under the theory that Ryan Phillippe is homophobic but also innocent, which is not true. He's just homophobic and guilty. But anyway, we think right now he's just one of those innocent homophobes. And under that theory, well, he's right-handed and the guy in the bar is left-handed. So it makes sense that the girl's black eye would be on the right side because he's left, you know, lefty hits the hit on the left hand. And so that's the whole thing. And they get the video from the bar that shows, aha, this, they were talking before and he's a lefty. And so that's good evidence, right? And so McConaughey drives his Lincoln on over to the prosecutor and is like, I'm going to show you this evidence that somehow you didn't have, which makes no sense. And he's thinking they're going to say, well, we better offer him a deal or let him off the hook or whatever, because this is great. And the prosecutor, who I guess is nobody, but I really keep thinking he's somebody, or he looks like, I don't know. Who's that guy look like? Am I crazy? Is he somebody?
He looked vaguely familiar, but not.
Yeah, I can't think of what it would be. Anyway,
like
he looks like everybody. He might be Ted Bundy, actually. Yeah, you know, where it's just like they said Ted Bundy got away with it because he just looks like
look like everybody. Yeah,
yeah, like vaguely pleasant looking.
That actor is now going to listen to this show and be like, sue us for defamation.
It might have been Ted Bundy is the actor. I mean, maybe something like that. Anyway, the guy who he's just vaguely fine looking and like just a basic white guy. And he says, no, we're still going through with it. We are going through with it. And so in McConaughey's mind, he's like, what's going on? I thought they were going to cut me a deal, but there must be something happening. And so there's like this dramatic tension. And then you come to find out, right? Are you going to, so is this when they're at the like picnic or some shit? And
it's really, really,
no
really,
sense.
Really stupid. It's internally contradictory, right? Because Matthew McConaughey does what you would do as a criminal defense lawyer here, mm-hmm. right? Which is you would go with your best piece of evidence to the district mm-hmm. attorney's office and say, look, we've got
hey,
this.
Hey, Ted Bundy.
And,
that's what you'd say. Yeah.
and you're not going to, you know, we're going to show this to the jury. And in addition to corroborating the like lefty righty thing, it shows that the victim, it shows that the victim approached Guilty McGilterson and handed him a napkin with her phone number and address on it, right? Which corroborates the story, right? And so, and that she's a prostitute, right? Yeah. So, and all of those are, if you are a criminal defense attorney looking to get your client off for assault, really, really good facts. And what you don't want, right? Like it's not a victory for your client if the state, if you hold on to your evidence, right, and you spring it, you know, via a series of surprise witnesses, each more surprising than the last. Like you
want to get the deal ahead of time.
Yeah, you want that. You want to convince. You want to be like, look, you don't want to try this case.
Yeah.
And so the movie gets all of that right in the behavior of Matthew McConaughey, and then has the prosecutor kind of like slyly, you know, Xanatos gambit it, or like it's like no, we're still going ahead, and I'm going to make you guess why.
And so, like, yeah, and so he,
you wouldn't. You'd do the same thing as the prosecutor. You'd be like, you think you're going to put this on, but here's what we have.
Right.
Ugh.
Yeah, so that maybe they would accept a worse deal or something. But so he has William H. Macy. By the way, William H. Macy, both a private investigator and I guess paralegal or like a secretary. Because he has him. He's like, why don't you compare the file that you got in advance somehow, which would be totally wrong and illegal, I'm guessing, to the file they gave us. And it turns out they like gave I can't make heads or tails of this. I really can't. What does this end up being? They gave him fake evidence, like a different knife that was in evidence. And then it turns out, well, no, they actually have a bloody knife that was really Ryan Phillippe's or whatever.
Yeah, I had to watch this twice. And it still
doesn't make sense.
I think I figured it out, right? So William H. Macy has a secret contact at the DA's office who he bribed to give him a copy of the file.
Sure.
But DA Ted Bundy knew that William H. Macy had a secret contact on the inside. So he took the file and they swapped out the key piece of evidence, which was the signature knife owned by Guilty McGilterson and covered in blood for just a knife, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't have any blood on it and doesn't belong to Guilty McGilterson. Also,
nobody was stabbed, so not sure why there's any blood on it, but whatever. It's fine. None of it makes sense. So much of this makes no fucking sense.
I think they've confused this crime with the previous
with the other crime.
I
think that's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is one of the many continuity errors in this movie. but now, right. And we're not going to talk about how Matthew McConaughey figures it out. It's really stupid. It's at a picnic. There's no reason for any of this. But now, instead of it just being like, oh, we have like her testimony and we've got the bar camera footage, which seems to show it's the other handedness. And she's a prostitute. And as Matthew McConaughey says, and again, let me be clear, like I'm not endorsing this position. I'm saying as a criminal defense lawyer, if your client is accused of raping a woman at knife point, the fact that the woman is a prostitute is a really, really good piece of defense, right? A piece of evidence to take to the defense, right? You go to the jury and you're like, he didn't have to commit assault in order to do that. That, again, that is not saying that, you know, prostitutes don't get assaulted. Obviously, we all know that. But from a movie strategic perspective, good evidence all of a sudden now turned into, oh, yeah, but we have your client's knife with the victim's blood on it. Which explains why they're not dropping the case.
But also, so, as you said, they wouldn't hide that from you.
Right.
There's no reason.
Yeah, they do. They like, oh, it's what they call a loaded deck, which, again, not a law thing because there's no reason. You would just be like, they would come in.
They want to try to get him to just plead guilty, right? Like, wouldn't they just want, yeah.
And the movie seems to know this, right? Because later on, they talk about how they've inflated the charges to try and get them to plead down, which is 100% a real thing, right? So, yeah, you don't hide your strength. You project strength because 99% of cases plead out. So, yeah.
Right.
So you got all that. There's no such thing
as
a loaded
deck. The only thing
that
was interesting about the picnic thing that I noted that was funny is like, oh, yeah, you've hired some people to play with your kid while you work. And I was like, because he's doing work and like other people are like playing with his kid, you know. It's just like, ah, 10 out of 10 can relate to that feeling that I would like to be able to just hire somebody to work with or play with my kids so I can do some work. But yeah, that's all.
Ooh, I like it. So then we cut back
on the park bench. Looks good, hon. Yeah, like I could relate. I'm just saying. Could
Fair
relate
enough.
To that, is all I'm saying.
So then I'd love
to be playing with my kid. I would love nothing more than to just sit and play with my kid. Sometimes you got some law business to do. Okay.
I'm not able to play with my kid right now because we're recording this.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know,
let's go play with Andrew's kid.
Yeah, well. So now we cut back over to the courthouse.
Is this where he goes and visits and there's some detective that just heckles him the entire time?
Yeah, it's Detective Curlin who shows up a bunch of times.
Yeah, Detective Buster Balls.
Yeah, right. Who's busting Matthew McConaughey's balls for the scum you represent.
Yeah.
And ordinarily, I would like that, right? Because, you know, you want, right, from a social perspective, to be like to represent in film the idea that all clients deserve an attorney. But the problem is McConaughey is played as such a shithead that like this is played as a fair criticism, right? Like it's not like he's making it up. It's not like it's wrong or whatever. And McConaughey's defense is like the very worst thing you can say, right? Like he's like, well, you know, my client was definitely guilty, but you know, the police tried to pile on these additional murders and they didn't. And so, Ha ha.
Well, they're like, doing the thing that they do in law stuff where this detective has just discovered the concept of defense attorneys. Like he's never, yeah. And he's like, what? There's people.
Yeah, he's in his 50s.
Yeah. There's an attorney that would defend the guy I'm trying to put into. It's like, yeah, they all work around the same things all the time. You know, it always fiction always has to treat it like this is the first time the detective has ever found out someone would defend a bad guy. You know, it's just annoying. It's like you've had this conversation or you never would even bother because you recognize that's how the fucking system works. Yes, there's going to be a lawyer on the other side. You all know that. Like, anyway, but he treats
but
it like
we need this for exposition elevators.
Yeah, so, yeah. He's ball busting. And like you say, McConaughey's counter is, well, you're not so great, which, you know, I kind of agree with. But he's like, yeah, you're not so great. I defended a guy. Sure, he did it. But then they tried to pile on two other unsolved murders onto him. So I got him off. And the other thing that seems to be an assumption with Detective Buster Balls is, well, you got him down to life instead of the death penalty. So he'll be out in 15. Is that how that works?
Yeah, this movie like vacillates between the like taking again and again because I think because the author of the book, right, has a high school education, right? And I don't think anybody involved in the law was consulted for the screenplay. So it's got like a grab bag of words they've heard from watching Law and Order. Right. So the DA is talking in the same breath about the federal sentencing guidelines, which, as all Law and Awful movies and opening arguments listeners know, you're not in federal court for assault. The federal guidelines say you're going to get 7, but, you know, that means you'll be out in 4. And, you know, the previous client like got life. That means he's out in 15. A, it's not federal court. And B, most states don't, you know, that's not the case anymore either, right? And certainly not.
Well, doesn't just depend, you know, like
there is a lot more discretion in the state systems, but almost every state system has gone to life without parole, meaning actually life without parole, right? Like it does not mean, you know, oh, I do life standing on my head because I'll be out in 15. It isn't. But this is all like a kind of a MacGuffin-y setup to meet Jesus Martinez. And there's a quick scene where he's chatting with Marissa Tomei again. She does another like drive by that's totally unethical. And they're talking about like how, you know, how much has she given away that the DA's office knows and blah, blah, blah. And,
yeah. All well, of it's that just for the scene for my sentence here. Oh, he's in bed with the prosecutor. That's all. That's the point of that. They get drunk together. She reveals some stuff. Kinda, and then they sleep together, and that's all that.
Yep, and all of that's unethical. And like, look, if you had a prosecutor whose ex-husband was a defense attorney, like, she'd just be walled off from every case that he was, right? Like, not...
Yeah.
You disclose that, right? Because you... Anyway, because of all of that. Because even if they didn't still have feelings for each other and sleep with each other occasionally, and which never gets resolved in the movie, by the way. It's not like they're, you know, there's a, like, happy they get back together for the sake of the child at the end. I don't think so.
I think you can read that. Well, we'll talk about it at the end. I think this movie does that thing that I think you've hated in the past, where fundamentally you're a bad guy if you defend, you know, criminals.
Yeah.
And then the resolution is he's learned that he's not going to defend criminals necessarily. So then it's kind of resolved in that way. I think is what the movie's going for. But anyway.
He still takes. He just doesn't take money from the biker. Anyway, we'll get there when we get there. But yeah, like that. all of that is totally unethical. And the reason you'd have that is because even if you hate, you know, you have two, you know, divorced parents who hate each other, like they would still get together for, like, you know, to hand off child custody and things like that. And you would just, you just have a rule that's like, yeah, okay, well, we're going to wall these off. Anyway,
there's plenty of work for everyone to go around, I'm sure, without needing to, like, you know, have everybody on the case. So, but he what is it? He, like, remembers an old case somehow that has very similar patterns. It's really weird.
It really, and then so this is the moment at which that inspired my little rant at the beginning, because, like, I think I understand now the plot of the movie, but it's, like, needlessly complex here, right? So what's happened is this, the crime that Guilty McGilterson is accused of is following the fact pattern of a crime that a former client of Matthew McConaughey with a different woman, it followed, except that woman got stabbed to death.
Yes.
And the client, Jesus Martinez, is in San Quentin. And that was foreshadowed two scenes earlier. And now we have, and there's like 10 minutes of Matthew McConaughey sort of figuring this out. It's weird because it's played as the exact same crime, but, like, there are really salient differences, right? Like, the biggest one being that the victim in the first one was stabbed to death.
Well, I think that we're supposed to, that's the thing about this movie. There's so much that doesn't make sense, but there actually is a lot of stuff where, oh yeah, I see they did work to try to make that thing make sense. So, like, it's not like they weren't working. It's just that they didn't have good law knowledge. And so sometimes they didn't realize, like, oh, that's stupid. But then also not just that. Anyway, it's inconsistent. I think we're to believe that the prostitute is telling the truth in that she, it just so happened that the way he attacked her, she was able to fight him off. Like, didn't it say during the struggle something happened and then she hit him with that vodka bottle or something? And yeah. So, like, that's, so I guess we're supposed to believe that he was going to kill her, but that happened and he got knocked out or something.
I think that's right. It
because he did still, like, have the bump on his head and all that. Like,
yeah. And it felt like there was going to be a little bit of, I don't know. I felt like you answering Thomas Takes the Bar exam on this, because like, because in the flashback of McConaughey asking McGilterson, tell me what happened. He's like, well, she hit me with something. And you see him getting hit with like a heavy object that doesn't shatter. And then In the replay flashback video, now that we're comparing it to the other crime, see, I told you it's confusing. You see her grab the vodka bottle and she smashes it over his head and it breaks open. And so I was sitting there thinking, like, oh, are they going to be able to, like, test for vodka or whatever? Or but no.
Yeah, they just bring Andrew Torres in. Smell this guy's head.
Yeah. Hey, I would not be, I am not a vodka expert by any means. No, all of
those
are
just
attractive
distractor answers. So he's got to fly to the Golden Gate Bridge to establish where his client is locked up. And then this, again, so many things. The problem is they run into an issue. They run into a plot thing they need to have happen sometimes. And they're like, well, we just need this to happen so people will act irrationally. We'll hope you forget about it. And then if you're doing a lot of movies, you won't have forgotten about it because you wrote it down. But he visits the guy who, on one hand, in two scenes ago, the detective is pissed because he got him 15 years, or, well, he got him life or whatever. Like, that was a upgrade to what he should have gotten. And then 5 minutes later, he's feeling so guilty that he only, you know, that he didn't believe that he was innocent, you know, because now he thinks, like, oh, wait, the similarities, maybe it was actually Ryan Phillippe the whole time. Maybe there's a reason that he was homophobic. And it's because he's a bad guy. And so he goes there and he's like, he's asking the guy in prison. He's like, let me show you these pictures. Tell me if you recognize anybody, because I want to see if it's the same guy who was there that night and whatever. And so he goes through pictures. The guy is like, no, no. And then he gets to the picture and the script says, guy all of a sudden possessed by demons. That's what happens. Yeah, yes. And he just decides, hey, I'm not, and he just goes nuts and he like leaves. And I don't really know why. Do you have any fucking idea why that was? He would just be like, oh, that's the guy you should. Because they try to play it like, oh, he's so mad that Matthew McConaughey didn't believe him the first time. And so now he's coming back. Oh, you've come back to finally solve this problem that, you know, you left me here in jail, rotting in prison. So I get that. Like, he's mad at him. But why all of a sudden, when you need him to identify Ryan Phillippe, he just goes nuts and loses it and says he's leaving? And makes no sense.
No one is so mad that they would like to stay in a maximum security prison over it. Yeah. I had to watch this scene like three times because it's bonkers, right? Like it makes absolutely no sense. And I'm still not clear how Jesus Martinez, the guy who was wrongfully convicted, on how he recognizes Guilty McGilterson, right? Like that the first time I watched this movie, I was like, oh, is this going to be like an elaborate kind of like, you know, Gene Hackman is going to show up and they're all part of a conspiracy in the Caymans and what? Like, that's what this would have been. If this had been, you know, a John Grisham novel, like.
Can I tell you this? My first impulse, like very early in the movie, was that it was going to be one of those like double, triple bluff things where McConaughey was actually doing this con with Ryan Phillippe to get more money out of the mom or something. Like that was, I actually thought that was what it was going to be. Like he was going to be trying to, you know, bill them for a billion hours of law services. And then like Ryan Phillippe and he would split the money when he got him off. Cause it turned out, you know, I thought it was going to be some super, but it got more murdery and rapey and evil than that actually.
Yeah. No, that was just a much good, better clean, movie fun. Yeah. Than the one we got. Yeah. Yeah, we could have had it. We could have then that comedy
because the tone is so goofy in the beginning.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, the tone is so like, oh, he's bilking these motorcycle dip-a-doo. So I was like, oh, that's what this is going to be. It's going to be a heisty thing. Like it'd be a little heist movie where it turned out they were. But no, it got a little.
If this was Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, but with Law and Matthew McConaughey, I would have loved this movie. Yeah, that would have been great. It's not. So we learn he's gone to go talk to Jesus Martinez. Jesus Martinez flips out. So Matthew McConaughey goes, meets back up with William H. Macy, who, by the way, is doing his best impersonation of the dude in this, right, from The Big Lebowski. Like, he's got the hair and the it's perfect. He's the dude. I'm skinnier because he's William H. Macy and he's 112 pounds. But basically, like, that's the look. And then you realize, right, there's the moment, right? This is the firm moment, right, which is less than, well, it's about halfway through the movie, in which he's like, okay, so my guy is guilty. He did the first one, and now he hired me for the second one because don't think too hard about that.
Well, because you see, the magic that Lord Voldemort invented, that is attorney-client privilege, means if you I don't even know if you had the other client, but then you're the lawyer for this one and you find out he did the other one, you can't say because magic binds your mouth together like in the Matrix.
Yeah, this is Double Jeopardy with Ashley Judd levels of crazy. So we can't just, so they literally had to write two scenes for this, right? So first, And it's like they wrote a scene, shot it, and then they were like, oh, we got to write another scene and shoot that. Like, and I totally agree. We're paying Matthew McConaughey by the hour. So like, by God, we're using that first scene. So they've got the scene with Matthew McConaughey and William H. Macy, like kind of figuring it out. And then they have the rich socialite Guilty McGilterson break into Matthew McConaughey's house.
Right. And well, sorry, hold on. I wanted to say something about that thing first. So I totally agree with you that they took several swings at this. They're like, is everybody on the same page? We've got the plot twist, everybody. And unfortunately, as much as I think William H. Macy is the best, he took this extreme conspiracy theory very well. Like, if you watch that scene, he barely reacts to this diabolical plot twist wherein it turns out the guy they were trying to defend was guilty of not only guilty of this crime, but also another murder. And he's just like, oh, well, what do you know it? You know, it's just like, what? Wow, he really took that well. And furthermore,
oh, you mean it's a number seven? Okay. Yeah. All right.
Exactly. And I love it too, because they try to build this up. Like, this is this just absolute, I don't know what the phrase would be, but it is just a no-win situation for Matthew McConaughey. They try to say, wow, he can't do anything. His hands are tied. And he says, wow, you can't bring, I typed it out. He goes, you can't bring it to the cops because he's your client. And you can't bring it to the DA because you'd lose your license. And I was like, wait a minute. Hold on. You're trying to set up this math, which, by the way, is all wrong. We all know that's all wrong, bullshit, legal, terrible. But assuming it's not, we are really to believe that the moral quandary here is that he might lose his license. Like, yeah. Okay, then just lose your license. Like, you're not going to, if the alternative is you've got a murderer who you're going to, like, get off scot-free and defend and, like, be a weird hostage in this current trial, or else you might lose your law license. Like, isn't he a fucking asshole if he doesn't just lose his law license?
Yeah, go start a podcast. Yeah, right? Exactly. It's 2011. You get it on the ground floor. You'd have, like, yeah. this is.
I mean, Thomas arguments. And the Bible had already been going strong for a year, yeah. But that's okay.
Right, yeah. But you could have hooked up with Matthew McConaughey, and, you know, it would have been... it would have been Lincoln arguments with Thomas and Matthew. It would have been great.
It would have been done out of a car. Right,
nice. So
and then you're totally right about like. I feel like people still aren't clear on this. Let's do another scene. Let's do another one, everybody. And Philippi has broken into his house, as you said.
Yes. And he has broken into his house, grabbed some of McConaughey's alcohol, like some scotch or something, poured himself a glass of it, and is like sitting in the chair in the cross between, you know, Dr. Claw from Inspector Gadget, and yeah. and is prepared to deliver the, like, Goldfinger.
He practically did the turnaround and swivel. Yeah. Like, yeah. I think they wanted to, and they're like, we can't, that's too far. That's that yeah. One thing is slightly too far. Everything else, keep it.
I'll get you, Gadget. Yeah. Yeah. No, it was that level of cartoonish supervillainy. And here's where we get, right, the firm level, the problem is attorney-client privilege,
yep.
Crossed with the, well, these two words mean this thing, so therefore magic, right? He says... Everything that ever happens between us is now, like, covered by attorney-client privilege.
Yeah.
That's not a thing, right? Like, so number one.
If you beat the living shit out of your lawyer, he can't press charges. Attorney-client privilege.
No, that's also not a thing, right? Like, so number one, it's called attorney-client privilege, right? Because the privilege belongs to the client for the stuff that he said. The stuff that you investigate and find out on your own, independent of your client, that's attorney dumpster privilege, right? Like that's not a privilege, right? Stuff outside the scope of your engagement, that's not a privilege. Stuff that isn't attorney work product or providing advice that has been requested by your client, that's not a privilege, right?
I feel like I've asked you this before, but I do really want to know. I'm sorry that it might be repetitive, but I can't quite remember. What would you do in not this absurdly stupid situation, but in a situation where, let's say you are a defense attorney, but you're not, you know, you don't like defending, like, horrible people, and you think your guy is innocent and you want to defend him, and then all of a sudden you discover something that's like, oh my God, this guy is, like, the worst murder, killer, rapist person. What, I mean, do you go to the police? Can you just... Be, like, throw him to the fire? Can you know, like, what do you have to do in that situation as an attorney?
No, so what you have to do, and again, we have some criminal law practitioners who listen to the show, so maybe they have some firsthand experience that they can provide. Let me tell you from my perspective. So number one, and this movie kind of hints at it a little bit, every criminal defense attorney knows, right, that the overwhelming likelihood is that their client is probably guilty in some way of something close to the fact pattern with which they're being charged, right? Even if your client protests that they are innocent, like, you have to have in the back of your head, like, yeah, but, you know, they all say they're innocent. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not like, it's not like I'm going to be shocked by this. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you enter into the practice, right. You enter into the representation knowing that that could happen. Right. So that's kind of number one, but number two, like suppose you've been totally misled the entire time. Right. And you're starting to go along and your thesis was this, and then you find out the evidence, you go to your client and you would say, okay, well now two terrible things are about to happen here. Because you've lied to me in this, you say, number one, because I now know X, I can't put you on the stand. I'm legally prohibited from putting you on the stand to say the stuff that we talked about you saying that would be consistent with the thesis of the case that I have developed mm-hmm. over the course of this trial. Because this trial is going on, by the way, while this is happening. And so you'd be like, hey, look, I've set this all up to, that our story is X, and I now can't put you on the stand to testify because I know that's not true and I'm prohibited from suborning perjury. And number two, you would point out, unlike this movie, where the only person with an intelligence over, below average is Matthew McConaughey and the people who work for him, you'd be like, look, if I found this out, I'm pretty sure the entire resources of the state that we're
well,
in
could no, but
find
like,
this
let's,
out.
sorry, I know this is a wild scenario, but like, let's say they never found the murder weapon, and then all of a sudden you find out your client is like hiding it somewhere that they just, something like that, where it's like, well, this is the evidence that would make or break it. I now know about it, but the police didn't find it or something. What do you do?
Yeah, you do not. So the answer there is you do not have the obligation. You do not have the reverse of the Brady obligation. Right.
Right.
So the prosecutor, when they discover exculpatory evidence, has to turn it over to you. The defense attorney, and again, this is reciprocal in terms of concept, even if not in terms of behavior, because the state has the police, right? They have mm-hmm. investigative arms. They've got far more resources. And so they're required to turn stuff over to you. You are not required to turn it back over to them. You are required, however, not to suborn perjury and to say, look, you may think you've done a great job of covering this up and maybe they don't have the smoking gun, but they're going to have things that point to this and it's going to make your case materially worse. And now that I know
what I would recommend is that we go, huh? What a lawyer you are. Jeez.
Yeah.
You're going to recommend what? Sorry, I didn't know you're still going.
I would say what you would do is you would say, let's go to the prosecutor and make their best plea bargain right now, right? Because your position will never be better with them than it is today. Because it's going to be hard for me to defend you when I don't know what they might find.
I don't like defense attorneys. I think that might be actually because like they got the bloody murder weapon or something. Can't anybody be a human and be like, I'm just going to tip off the police of where this is or something. I'm not going to try to get this clear murder. You could, but then you wouldn't get paid. No, I'm just kidding.
So. But I want to emphasize this, and again, maybe I'm too much of a lawyer here. Like, I'm not answering this as if it's a trolley problem question, right? Like, if it's a trolley problem question, and I'm 100% convinced, if you stipulate for the facts, I'm 100% convinced that he's guilty, then yeah, right? I will call I'll anonymously get a, burner cell phone, find the like one place on earth that still has a payphone or whatever, which, by the way, why do you have to do that?
There's no way you can just say, hey, this came to my attention. I can't ignore this because I have ethics and I don't want to defend an innocent man. So I'm going to, or sorry, defend a guilty, murder. So here, I'm turning this over. You have to do it like anonymously?
So the reason that I would do it anonymously even in this situation is because of the long-term consequences, right? Like because and let me be super clear about this. And again, not an issue that I face because I don't represent criminal defendants. But if I did, right, I need to tell you, it is 100% imperative that a criminal defendant feel confident that they can tell their lawyer everything. That's the key to the system working. And it means that sometimes they may tell you stuff you'd rather not hear. But if I have to say to a client like, hey, you can absolutely tell me anything. And the client's like, didn't your last client tell you stuff that you then immediately went and told the police? Right. Like that rule doesn't work. Right. Like I would not want to compromise my representation of my later clients who may be innocent or who may be innocent of the charges that have been brought against them or who right. may be entitled to a vigorous defense. Right. Like I don't.
All right.
Puppy
down.
Saying hi. Yep. So,
well, all right. We got to get back. Yep. Thanks for the answer.
It's a good question.
Maybe
but
the
here,
reason
yeah,
I've,
so
yeah.
If it's a trolley problem and I know he's guilty, I make an anonymous call. But, and Law Dog agrees. But in reality, I'm likely to still harbor a doubt. And because because you're innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, like I can't prejudge that, you know, I like even if I find, you know, a gun with my client's fingerprints on it, like I'm going to go to my client and be like, how do you explain this? Man, I'm not comfortable with taking that out of the system because the other side isn't going to do that. Right. They're going to do what they're obligated to do. But they're not going to. They're not gonna
yeah.
disobey the rules on their side. So
yeah, have you explained the double jeopardy firm nonsense enough here?
Yeah.
In this
well,
scene?
That's I yeah. think so, right? So guilty McGilterson is like, ha, you're entrapped. everything is attorney-client privilege. So screw you. And then he confesses that part, by the way, is true. Like that Matthew McConaughey can't testify. My client confessed to the murder, but that's right. The only thing. Right.
That's right. I killed. Was it Ned Thompson? Or, I already forget. What is it? Something like that.
Oh God. So we need good. To do more Perry Mason or
I know. I just want that clip all the time. It's the best.
I agree.
Yeah. So he does that. And then we get okay. Here's the thing. Someone shot William H. Macy, and therefore
because it's a movie and William yep. H. Macy is in it, and no one ever pays yeah. for William
Sometimes
H. Macy to
he
stay
shoots,
alive. In
William
a movie.
H. Macy shoots William H. Macy in some movies.
Is there any movie that William H. Macy lives through?
Sure, I think, but there,
but not
he,
many.
He doesn't always make it. Yeah, I think you're also thinking of Sean Bean is the one that really. He does not make it through a movie ever
yeah.
in the history of time.
That is true.
But anyway, at this point, he probably just asks, like, you got to kill me. I don't care if this is whatever this is. It's a kid's movie, sir. Sorry. I got to be shot. But anyway.
You're playing Olaf in Frozen 2.
Yep. Got to lop my head off with a sword. It's got to happen. Script it in. But anyway, so this is so funny.
How great would that be?
Yeah.
Sean Bean is Lightning McQueen in Cars yeah. 4.
It's just a huge accident, just explosion. So I love this because I forget what fucking Matthew McConaughey is doing at the time, but Marissa Tomei comes over and is like, hey, you're going to want to go trample a live crime scene and like touch the victim and stuff for some reason. And he's like, okay. So he goes over to where William H. Macy used to be alive. And he just waltzes in. He's like, oh, I'm family or whatever. He goes to the police. And he's just like trampling over the crime scene and all this stuff. And they just let him. And they're like, oh, hey, how's it going? It's really funny. And we get a nice little cameo here. Bryan Cranston.
Oh, Bryan Cranston.
When he was still,
I have the same note.
Yeah, when he was still kind of breaking into movies back then. I think he was still just starting to get going with his movie career. So it was a pretty small role, but nevertheless, he's still amazing because I love Bryan Cranston. He's the lead detective on this. And it turns out that and I love this because I can't tell if they decided this midway through. Remember how I talked about like, oh, they made it make sense that he's a homophobe? Well, while William H. Macy's dead body is there, somebody's like, hey, why are there all these pictures of a man? And he's like, because he's gay or whatever. You know, they just like answer the question. And I feel like they tried to shoehorn that in like after the fact, because they could have established that so much easier earlier on. And there's no reason for it to be a reveal or anything. But
yeah,
I think
it doesn't affect the plot in any way
no,
whatsoever.
But it gives more motivation to like, oh, why he was a, you know, Ryan Phillippe is a homophobe, so that's a clear sign that, like, he also might have just wanted to kill William H. Macy anyway. You know, that kind of thing. Like, it just lends more to the motive or whatever. But, like, they didn't, they could have established it so easily, but they choose to, like, after he was dead to be like, oh, there's all these pictures. But anyway, and then that's it. That's the only thing you hear of it, is that one thing. Yeah, so he's been killed, and we think it's likely by Phillippe at this point, because he was onto something. And, man, what else happens here? Where are we now?
And again, this is going to be like one part of like eight or nine in which I say this, but like, this makes no sense if you stop to think about it for a minute, right? Like, Matthew McConaughey is your lawyer. William H. Macy is his investigator who's got contacts all over town and is the magic guy who can get whatever you need. Like, you don't want your lawyer to do a shitty job in your murder trial, your assault trial, right? Like, you want your lawyer to do a good job in that trial. So killing his right-hand man, that doesn't make any sense. And it never does. Like, it never makes any sense.
Yeah, it's so weird because
even with the twist at the end, it never makes any sense.
Oh, my God. The twist at the end is the dumbest thing ever. It makes everything worse. But Phillippe, from his perspective, he knows he is A, guilty of the crime, but B, also expects McConaughey to easily get him off of the charges, you know? Like, but you actually did it. So how are you just counting on the fact that he can get you free of these charges that are actually right?
I don't know. And I'm going to kind of like skip a couple, because it does some quick cross-cutting here, and we can't do, like, you know. But
well, all I can say is he decides to go get real sweaty at a bar. That's what Matthew McConaughey the show at a bar is just like glitch.
Yeah, and we learn, so the key thing that we learn over the next 11 minutes that could have been in 30 seconds is that Ryan Phillippe, Guilty McGilterson, has stolen the unique gun that belongs to Matthew McConaughey, because we have to have an exact analog of the unique knife that only belongs to Guilty McGilterson, and is going to use that to use that gun to shoot William H. Macy, and is gonna frame Matthew McConaughey for it, which again is now moment number two of your plot makes no sense, because if your lawyer gets arrested in the middle of your criminal defense,
well, I think he just wants leverage over him to be like, okay, yes, you know the truth, but you have to do a great job still. It seems it's like a little hostage situation is what we're
right, but talking. But then that makes no sense of the point where the DA calls and says, hey, your gun is a special antique and we still have a bullet from blah, blah, blah. It's kind of, it's like a Star Trek techno babble here, but basically they're like, you know, we can still run ballistics on this, even though we don't have your gun or the bullet.
Because it was a famous gun used in a case that his father did. Right. And so they can go back to the 50 years ago and use that.
Yeah.
Which and is so interesting. That would have been a good CSI episode, but they don't ever use that for anything.
No. No. So, but, and that the undermines
we have
the,
to talk about very quickly. I just have to mention William H. Macy is the hilarious voice message that they do, where eventually, because he didn't know it at the time, but eventually Matthew McConaughey gets around to checking his voicemail and he hears William H. Macy going, hey, I've got the crucial plot info for you. And oh, hold on. Someone's at the door. Just give me one sec. Gonna be murdered. And also my dog. Talk real soon with that key info. Call you right back. And then it cuts out.
So, I love exposition voicemail is my all time favorite, even over exposition radio. We get that. And now, and we still, then the movie's got to cut back to, the state's case in chief against Guilty McGilterson to remind us that, you know, this is a law procedural movie, right? So so we get the testimony from the first guy in the bar, right?
So weird.
This is weird. And all of these witnesses will do the, like, thing that they occasionally do in the later seasons of Law and Order, where, like, the scumbag witnesses are kind of like sitting in the witness box like they're about to eat an apple and, like, you know, kind of monologue over it, right? Like, that they're just like, that, you know, they just went to, you know, douchebag 101 before taking the stand. The direct, it is pretty okay on this, right? Like, it's like, oh, so, you know, you were with so-and-so. Yeah, she was a prostitute. Yeah, you left. And, you know, yeah, I paid her $400 and I left. Did you see anybody else? No, I didn't. There's a couple leading questions, but by and large, you know, whatever, for a movie, it's fine. Mm-hmm. Then we get cross-examination, and this is the moment in which you realize, oh, the district attorney is being played as it's an alternate universe, like Tom Hanks from Big, and it's a 12-year-old inhabiting the body of the district attorney. That's the only thing you can explain.
Or the prosecutor?
The prosecutor.
Okay.
That's the same, right? Yeah. So,
oh, it's the same. Oh, I got you.
Yeah. So it's okay. It's just nuts, right? Like, so he object, right? The first question on cross-examination, I don't even remember what it is, because I didn't make a note.
Because
I was starting
stupid.
There's a like bullshit objection, and the judge is like, no, that's fine. And then Matthew McConaughey like goes through 87 questions that are hearsay about Shaquilla Shackles, a BDSM prostitute, and there's zero objections. Yeah. In fact, that may be the like one perfunctory stupid objection that the prosecutor makes at the start of the trial. Like, he gets the judge like slaps him down, and I think that's the last objection he makes in this movie, which has 50 minutes left to go, by the way. Yeah. So, you know, so he's just there to, like I said, you know, Washington generals it up, like, you know, to set up Matthew McConaughey so that he can do things that only work if you have a 12-year-old inhabiting the body of your prosecutor, which they do.
But like, okay, it's so confusing. The DA, the prosecutor, I guess thought he had a case but didn't. But on the other hand, so they play it like he somehow had no case, but also had no idea that he had no case. So then after this, like, whatever, first day of testimony, whatever it is, he's, like, all dejected and like, oh, no. But, I mean, he has
his facial, the guy, and he kind of looks like, who's the dude from Thank You for Smoking?
Aaron Eckhart?
Aaron Eckhart. I think he looks a little Aaron Eckhart-y. But anyway, maybe. Like, he looks like Aaron Eckhart if Aaron Eckhart wore his emotions on his sleeve, like he was playing "Wear Your Emotions on Your Sleeve" in a theater production.
Yeah, because you want to signal to the jury that you're full of shit as a prosecutor. That's definitely like when something happens, you go, "Oh God, oh!" And then the judge asks you, "Hey, you got any other witnesses?" And you're like, "Oh fuck, oh." That's always good. That's a good way to get a guilty verdict, I think. He looks like a white Raul Esparza. That's a kind of
I like that.
Raul Esparza? I thought nobody would get that. But,
I get that. But that's better than my Aaron Eckhart.
Let me ask you this. I know that I get that it's like, okay, she's a prostitute, so oftentimes there's trouble with, you know, how believable juries find prostitutes, whatever. But like, she testifies that I am the victim of this crime and this man did it, who I am identifying, who was, you know, had my blood on him and all this stuff. And they're acting like, well, you're full of shit. There's no chance we can convict on this evidence. Am I missing something?
No, I don't think you're. I think it's just badly written.
It's bad.
Right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. It's not right.
Well, as you point out, like, we go from that. There's some cross-cut scenes that don't really matter, except that, like, the office assistant that showed up in scene one is now back to be, because I feel like they wrote the second half of the movie and they were like, and then we'll have William H. Macy get, you know, X, Y, and Z. Yeah. And somebody else was like, oh, no, wait, we just killed him off. And
not only like, did him retroactively gay, we killed him off.
And I'm like, oh, well, all right, how about that receptionist from the beginning? Can we have her? And they're like, yeah, fine, whatever. So there's a little bit of that.
And we skipped a whole subplot where, like, some girl that he's helping out turns out to be mopping a floor in a men's prison for no reason. and talks to the guy. It's so dumb.
Yeah, I have this as I do have the notes on it, but like we've got the
we gotta get going.
She's MacGuffin-y MacGuffin something about.
Well,
the
it's
MacGuffin.
Like a quadruple bluff where I mean, and it is kind of interesting. Look, I get the again dramatically trying to set up the scenario where it's like your lawyer is essentially a hostage, but he wants. You know, he wants the client to, in the end, not get off, but he can't be too obvious about it because then he tips off that he did something. So he, like, does this circuitous thing, which I think is kind of clever, and I do like it, even if, though legally it makes no sense, where he gets a somebody who doesn't even know Ryan Phillippe to claim that Ryan Phillippe confessed to this murder or to this crime. And then also another murder that the original murder that Jesus Martinez was convicted of, so that Matthew McConaughey can like signal to the detectives that like he's the guy. It's very circuitous, and I do kind of like it, but it makes no fucking sense legally.
Yes,
speaking.
Yeah,
but like twisty, you know, tension speaking. I liked it.
But yeah, so back to – so the victim and I will say like the cross-examination – again, you have to understand the like Harlem Globetrotters nature of it. But once you get that, it's not bad. And one of the things I really did like – and since we're, you know, bashing a lot of this movie, the thesis that Matthew McConaughey is advancing in the trial, right, which is – reasonably consistent, is this is all a setup. It was consensual sex between his client and the victim, a prostitute who was running a scam and used the first guy set up the guilty McGilterson. And there's this great turn that like really felt like good lawyering to me, where all of a sudden, like he switches from being like super aggressive in the questioning to like almost sympathetic, right? Like, so all of the like contradictions in her story come out because the prosecutor has like gone out for pizza and has decided not to object to any questions. that's cool. but then like there's kind of this moment in which he's like, so being prostitute's really hard work. And she's like, yeah. And he's like, and in fact, you know, you're looking for ways to get out of the business, right? You've talked to, you know, your friends and you've said that. Yeah. And so getting a really big score from somebody, that would go a long way, wouldn't it? Right. And he takes that tone, and it's exactly what a real lawyer would do to try and cast doubt on the credibility of someone and switching up tone, right? Like some of, all right, you've come out and you're framing my client, and then kind of switching into, but all right, I get why you would, right? It was good. It was a really, really good moment. But then that great moment is immediately undone by the camera panning over to prosecutor Aaron Eckhart, who has a bucket under his forehead because of the way he's sweating, right? Like it is literally pouring off of him. He's like reaching into his collar like it's Rodney Dangerfield circa 1982. It's amazing.
Even the worst attorney in the history of fucking time, if they are at that position, is gonna know no matter what, you're gonna show your poker face for the jury's sake, right? Aren't you always gonna kind of look like things are going according to plan?
Yeah.
It's absurd. Yeah.
Come on is the right response there. Yeah. And now we get Guilty McGilterson's mom is on the stand.
This is very confusing. I don't even understand. And
she's put on, and again, this is one of these, and I want to explain. This only could possibly work in a movie in which you know that the other side's lawyer is reading from the script that you wrote for them, right? So what happens is they want to put her on the stand to explain why.
The knife, right? Isn't it just that?
It's just to explain the existence of the knife. Now, that's, again, real law stuff. You need to explain why your rich socialite son was carrying this knife. And she says, "Sure, oh, I gave this knife to my son on, you know, July 7th, 2007, and he always carries it with him." And Matthew McConaughey is like, "Great, no further questions."
Yeah,
I'm done.
And then the prosecutor's like, "How can I make this as bad as possible for me?"
And so this is a comical textbook example of two principles that literally every lawyer learns in their trial advocacy class in the first semester of law school, right? And the first is you never ask a question in cross-examination that you don't know the answer to.
Right.
And the second is that you never ask the question too far. This prosecutor tramples all over all of that. It's like, "So, Mrs. Vandersnoot, you seem awfully sure of the exact date that you handed out this knife."
Right.
"I am. And in fact, June 7th, 2009, was it in the newspaper? No. Was it a public holiday? No. Well, I'm confused, Mrs. Yeah. Vandersnoot, then. How could you possibly remember the detail?" And as it's coming out, you're like, because that's the day in which I was assaulted and raped. And you're just like,
it's literally from the British Office when they're acting out the scene and he's the hotel clerk and Ricky Gervais is an asshole. And he's like, "There's been a rape." Like, it's honestly like that exact scene from The Office is that, except this horrendous prosecutor having no idea what he's doing.
Oh, God. Yeah. So that's
flustered.
Disaster.
He's like, "Oh my God, I never saw any of that coming. I thought my whole case hinged upon the mom maybe fudging a date in when she knew that she gave him the knife, as though that was going to be anything anyway."
If you don't know, right, then again, think about how this would play with a real lawyer. Like, you would put the mom on the stand, right, and then and she would say, "Well, I gave it to him on, you know, July 7th, 2009. And then if you don't know anything, you would either say, "All right, no questions for this witness." Or if you have one kind of area of questions about it, right? And look, this is a rich socialite mom with her son. Like, you could probably find where she fixed a test for him in, you know, 2005 in high school or whatever, right? And so you would get up and you'd be like, "So I want to ask you about X. And in fact, your son, you know, plagiarized this assignment and you called the principal and got that changed from an F to a B, right? And really, there isn't anything you wouldn't do for your son. Isn't that right, Mrs. Vandersnoot?" And then she'd be like, "Well, no, I certainly wouldn't do X." And you'd be like, "Okay, no further questions," right? Like, that's it that what you would do with this witness. And let me add, and I don't always ascribe to this theory, but standard cross-examination theory is you script everything out, right? And you begin and you end with your best questions, right? Again, I
just for like the attention of the jury and stuff.
Yeah, because cross-examination often takes hours and like the jury's mind wanders and they get bored in the middle. And so, you know, you want to start with a bang and end with a bang. I don't always follow that. I don't usually. Well, but in any event, not almost Aaron Eckhart. He gets embarrassed, asks the question too far, looks like an idiot, and is like,
"Yeah." And then he just quits.
He's like, "No more other questions. I'm going to go home and cry."
One thing that I think is funny about this movie and this extended courtroom scene is tell me if this ever happens. Whenever something goes bad for somebody, the judge is instantly in with like a Mr. Eckhart, Mr. whatever, you know, Mr. Ted Bundy, like right away, like 1 second of pause, and he's like, "Mr. Bundy, did the trial just go badly for you?" And he's like, "Yep, give me a minute." So funny.
I just want to point out for the jury that that was a bad court thingy.
The judge is like, instruct the jury that this was bad for the prosecution.
So
he's essentially
that
like,
ends.
"Mr. Ted Bundy, do you want to give up the practice of law?" He's like, "Yes, I do. Actually, I'm going to leave right now." And then he leaves.
So that went so badly. The court adjourns for the day. And then we see Matthew McConaughey coming back up to his client going like, the DA has now offered you 6 months in prison. And I know that we set up at the first meeting before Matthew McConaughey figured everything out. He was like, I'm innocent, no deals. But all the facts have changed now. Like, now we know he's totally guilty. And like that whole I'm innocent, no deal. Like, he repeats it again, even though that makes no sense. And like, I just want you to think, like, this movie could have ended right here, right? Like, if this were reality, you come and you'd be like, hey, we both know you're guilty. We just had a great day in court. And because the DA is 12, he went.
Yeah, we really lucked out in that even though you are guilty, he's so bad at his job that we're going to get you with this deal. But I think that the way they tried to explain it,
you would take that beyond your wildest dreams. You'd be like, yep. OK,
well, no, the way they tried to explain it was, well, not only does he like murdering prostitutes, he also likes seeing an innocent like person go to jail in his place for it.
Right. But like, that's never that's not on the table. Like, they're not even talking about if he. It's
he's evil. OK, you don't get it. He's evil. Yeah, that's why he was homophobic in the beginning.
He's stroking right here. But the plot demands that his name is Roulette. So I just finally have that in my notes. The plot demands that he not take it because, you know, if he were to take it, like I said, the movie kind of ends and it's like, and the moral of the story is being rich and having your lawyer pays. But we've got to go back to the trial. And now the one thing that Matthew McConaughey definitely can't do is the thing that he does, which is put guilty McGilterson on the stand to lie about what happened. And there he like Brett Kavanaugh's the fuck out of this, right?
Yeah,
like,
he does.
Yeah. Like, he asks him the question and he turns, you know, to the jury and says, and I was just going for beers with PJ and Squee and my calendar. And and you see like
the jurors
nodding along.
Yeah.
Oh, God, it's terrible.
I might have been sorry. I thought I got a little ahead of you, I think, where I was. Sorry. I was trying to skip as much as we could. But are we at the surprise witness? Each more surprising
than the last?
We are
now. Yes. So we're now there's the MacGuffin thing because the state has decided it's gone so badly. They're going to bring out their special rebuttal witness, never minding that he's not there to actually rebut anything.
I know. Yeah.
And by the way, just law wise, like, a rebuttal witness is confined to rebut the thing that
you'd
that
think. It's sort of in the name, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. And one of the objections that you can raise is when someone's testimony goes beyond the scope of the testimony they're there to rebut, which this guy, that's all he is there to do. He's the prison snitch. This is the big day, and there's all kinds of like Perry Masoning it up. Like, Marissa Tomei is hanging out in the galley. There's a it's dumb.
Well, because it's important that she sees he finally doesn't like bad guys anymore or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
And she's
but he has arranged
way,
this whole thing. So like he has arranged, which I kind of, you know, again, I like it in the intrigue way of the movie, Legally Stupid. But he has arranged that he like fed what was obviously going to be an easily discreditable witness to the prosecutor to use. And then he discredits him. And then you're like, whoa, but you just got this bad guy off by easily discrediting him. But then wouldn't you know it, as they walk out, they got Ryan Phillippe off and you're like, what's going on? They walk out and then the police are like, you're under arrest, Ryan Phillippe, for the other murder that because we overheard the guy say that. I don't even know.
It's so bad. So here's what's happened. Matthew McConaughey has gotten one of his other clients, who happens to be working as a janitor in the men's prison, where this guy is a prison snitch, has fed him a line and has said, I'll get you out of jail if you go on the stand and testify as to all the details of the first crime, in which the victim was actually stabbed to death. So he does that. Matthew McConaughey impeaches him because, of course he does, because this guy's a jailhouse snitch and he makes everything up. And the only sensible thing that the prosecutor says in this entire movie, which is, everything that guy said on the stand was a lie. Like, that was the whole point of your impeachment. it doesn't matter, and everybody who hated Matthew McConaughey is convinced, instantly understands this, you know, double reverse gambit, and they arrest the Roulet, the guilty McGilterson, and that's it, right? Happily ever after, movie's over. No. Movie's not over, despite the fact that this is 102 minutes, and that would be the logical point to end the movie, right? You'd be like, yeah, he did it, right? The end.
They got
the end. Yeah, that's all you need. You need like a 2-minute denouement. Like,
we need one more twist, kind of.
Can I add, by the way, the whole scene with the prison informant features the most unintentionally hilarious bit in the movie, which is, again, the DA has been reduced to the role of potted plant. So prosecutor is making zero objections here, despite, you know, all sorts of like hearsay coming in and everything. And then pipes back up for the one thing that he should know you can't object to, which is they're trying to introduce a newspaper headline into evidence. And like, that's one of the hearsay objections, hearsay exceptions. But prosecutor doesn't know that because he's a 12-year-old boy in the body of a prosecutor and is like, a news report? Come on, Your Honor. And the judge is like, does the Futurama, like, I want to see where this goes. I'm going to allow it.
Right? How often does that happen? Because in this movie, it happens constantly. No, is that a real thing where they're like, well, we'll see. Like, I'm gonna wait. Wouldn't it just be, oh, you're right, that's a thing you can't do or not, right?
Yeah, no, the most real judges do not answer. Yeah, me and the viewing audience are really curious as to where this is going. No, like,
popcorn,
you just
going.
Apply the rules. and then at the end, the judge actually objects before the lawyer can, which is great, and then goes to dress him down in chambers and is like, how could you have put on this guy who came out the back? And by the way, like, none of that's appropriate, right? Like, if the prosecutor gets to put on whatever witnesses they want, and if they suck, like, that's a matter for the jury, right? Like, the judge doesn't
get involved. What does the judge give a shit for?
The judge shouldn't give a shit, but he does in this case because reasons.
There's a real dressing down in the judge's chambers. It's fun.
Yeah. And that's just done so that the prosecutor comes back and is like, we agree that we're going to drop all the charges. Except they don't say we agree that we're going to drop all the charges because, again, this movie is cobbled together from bits that people have heard from other legal movies. So they say, we've filed a motion to dismiss. You don't have to move to dismiss your own indictment. But they do in this movie.
They dismiss it with prejudice.
Right. Which is that is an actual thing, but that's a thing borrowed from civil. Anyway, like, you don't have to dismiss a criminal indictment
with
prejudice. Are they
prejudicing themselves? Like, we dismiss our own charges with prejudice to ourselves.
No, I'm really glad that you caught that because this is 100% just like stolen from civil lawsuits. You don't have to dismiss a criminal indictment with prejudice because of double jeopardy, right? Like, once somebody's been indicted, they cannot be tried for the same offense twice. In a civil case, if I move to dismiss a count, like, suppose I sue you for trespass and I don't in my complaint actually allege that you were on my property. You move to dismiss. You're like, it doesn't even allege that I was on the property. The judge is like, really? Good point. I'm dismissing this count, but I'm going to dismiss it without prejudice. That means I can freely amend the complaint and just add in the allegation. Oh, by the way, Thomas Smith was on my property. Dismissing something with prejudice means you can't allege that claim arising out of those facts again. Which happens when you adjudicate. You don't say it's a pleading defect. You say, okay, you made a full statement of this, but now, like, I've decided that's not sufficient as a matter of law, and there's nothing you can do to salvage this complaint or this claim in this complaint. So I'm going to dismiss it out with prejudice. So with prejudice means can't bring the charges again. Doesn't apply in the criminal context because everything is with prejudice in the criminal context. So that's that. We get another like pointless scene with John Leguizamo again, in which,
this made no sense. This was something I said, put a pin in, and I would skip it, except I said, put a pin in, cause he thought, so Matthew McConaughey thought he remembered, oh yeah, John Leguizamo claimed he referred this case to me back in the beginning of the movie, but I've come to find out that, Ryan Phillippe already wanted me, you know, obviously, because that's the whole plot of the movie, because of the, I almost said double jeopardy rules or whatever, you know, attorney client privilege rules. So therefore, maybe John Leguizamo was in on it. Also because the guy had an ankle bracelet on, so how could he have killed William H. Macy? So maybe John Leguizamo somehow figured that out. I don't even know. And so he thought he was like the bad guy. And then for all we knew, he was a bad guy. But then he needs something, so he calls him up and is like, forget that whole subplot where you're the bad guy. Now you're the good guy again. And we don't ever learn why or why not.
Yeah, and he could have just stayed the good guy the whole time. We also get some patented John Leguizamo shtick in which he's like, oh, yeah, after you accuse me of this, you got more balls than a Chinese ping pong tournament. I am 100% positive John Leguizamo wrote that line himself. that's terrible. So that's the way to mean that Matthew McConaughey can track where Guilty McGilterson is going, but
which you also didn't really even need because
he's going to go threaten his family. So somehow Matthew McConaughey gets there first. Like, I don't know if he teleports or something, but he gets there first and is waiting on the porch. And now I guess because, the prosecutor's role is over, it's now Roulet's turn to act stupid for no reason. So he's shown up at like 4 PM to brutally murder the family of the lawyer whose actions got you arrested. Cause no one ever goes down for that. Right.
Like that. Again, stuff I was trying to skip, but it's too stupid. I got to mention it. They did this whole thing where like they arrested him for that old murder. And then they're like, well, yeah, we don't, it's not going to stick because we don't have anything. We just really wanted to arrest him. And so they let him out within an hour or something. And it's like, either you're going to arrest him and do the thing we've seen in every movie where you can hold him for 48 hours, I think it is, right? Because you got at the time, that's every movie. I don't know if that's accurate, but that's what it is. Or you wouldn't bother arresting him. Pick one. You can't do the, well, we're going to arrest him and then we let him out right away. That was more for fun. It was just for me to arrest real quick. And they let him out.
Yes.
And then this I saw coming from 40,000 miles away. There's going to be a confrontation. But also, Matthew McConaughey has a gun, so he didn't even need this particular part. But they're going to have maybe an altercation. But then wouldn't you know it, the biker gang from the beginning of the movie. They come. And they, for some reason, McConaughey can't shoot him because reasons. But a biker gang can just kill him with impunity and it's fine and nobody will face any consequences.
Yeah, and I guess and Matthew McConaughey is like, send him to the hospital, not the morgue, which, but by the way, is now like,
that's a crime.
Now we're in, that's a crime. And B, like, remember how Guilty McGilterson comes from the like rich family? Like, they are now suing Matthew McConaughey until the end of time.
Yeah.
Right. Like that, because it's not going to be super hard to prove that your lawyer's clients came and beat the shit out of you.
Yeah. Right outside of your family's door.
Outside of your family's house, yeah.
Fine. It's biker law. Like, there's nobody, not a court in the land could convince them or convict them.
So we have one last scene in which Matthew McConaughey goes back to his apartment, and now the mom has broken into the apartment.
This is like something they accidentally left in the movie. Like, honestly, of all the twists that didn't need to happen. And once she was there, I was like, oh, she's the one.
I feel like the producer of this movie lost a bet with someone who was like, you must include 12 more terrible movie.
Yeah.
Oh, and he's like, oh, and you only have 3 more minutes of runtime to do it in. Yeah. Go. Right. So, I mean, we went lightly over how I get that, like, the socialite is a sociopath. So, but like, that doesn't mean that he has breaking and entering skills, right? Like, but whatever. He does some throwaway line of, like, I'm a realtor. I can get into anyone's house I want, which not a thing.
Yeah.
Not a thing.
It's usually because they give you the key. It's not like every realtor is blessed with telekinetic powers or whatever. Of like,
I have so many questions for Teresa Gomez right now.
So funny.
But not explained, not even with the throwaway line.
By the way, that's how you become a realtor. You show an early promise for pickpocketing and picking locks and other things. And they're like, why, you've got it, what it takes to be a realtor. You know why? Because you got to be able to get into any
where they give you the keys. So mom doesn't even get a throwaway line. We just assume now, like, all right, anybody can get into Matthew McConaughey's place.
Even Matthew McConaughey is treating her like this is an unnecessary twist. Because she's like, hey, I'm trying to tell you that I was the one who shot. And he's like, all right, okay, all right, thanks. And he signs an autograph.
Oh, she does a like, hey, I'm monologuing here. And he's
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Yeah, whatever,
he starts to
man,
leave. But... he's like, I can't. Are we really doing this? A boom mic goes in the frame. And he's like, are we doing this last twist? Hey, I'm still talking. And then she shoots him and he shoots her and he's like, oh, I guess we are doing that stupid twist for no reason.
Yeah. And again, like that fantastic movie trope where she shoots, he's just turns back around. She's had the gun trained on him.
Yeah.
She shoots him first. And then he, as he's falling, shoots her in response. They both, like, neither one, like, shoots each other in the face or
dies.
Whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And she is 100% dead, right? Like, she's dead as if he's got, like, the disintegrator ray on her. Like, and Matthew McConaughey is, like, fine, right?
It passed through, hit no organs or blood vessels or anything. It doesn't matter. He's fine.
He's but done. I don't died. Even think there's a squib, right? Like, he's, like, lying on the floor. There's no blood pool. There's no nothing.
Well, he wakes up in the hospital, so... yeah,
he does wake
happened.
Up in the hospital, but he wakes up in the... he doesn't even have the, like, little bandage on.
What a stupid ending, though.
Oh, my God.
This
yeah, and
really
it's
dumb.
There's no reason for it. But then we get some cool-ass music as the movie ends. Again, movie soundtrack, kind of weird.
The last song, I actually love this song, but I've heard it 7 billion times because for some reason, from the years about 2000... I'd say 13 through probably 2017, this was one commercial that had to be during every commercial break of a Sharks game, which means I saw it every time because I watch every Sharks game and also every single commercial break. So not just like, oh, once during the game. No, every single time, which is... well, it sounded here, like I would hear that same little intro part of that song every time. And it was some car commercial where they're driving through California, you know, because the song is like California. So, and I like it
for me because I don't listen to new music. I don't really watch that much television, and I definitely don't ever watch the Sharks. I've never heard this song before,
it's
so I was like,
song.
"Yeah, it's kind of cool." Yeah, like, no, you know, whatever.
I still don't hate it, but I had to hear it peppy, a lot of times. Yeah.
I get it. No, oh, believe me, I totally get when you get that. Oh my God, like that.
But instantly, I went into like flashbacks. I was like, "Fuck! Oh, who's on that? What's what period is it? Are we winning? Oh no, it's the end of this."
It's the end of the movie. So then we get the biker gang has him pull over again, and he's like, and they're like, yeah, remember, we're a murderous biker gang, drug dealing syndicate. And this is a direct line from the movie. One of our associates was caught with 50 kilos of cocaine.
Yeah.
I'm not, again, precious little cinnamon bun. That seems like a lot, right? Like that was more than the cocaine in Beverly Hills Cop, in which like the guy was basically Pablo Escobar. And Matthew McConaughey is like, no probs, 50 kilos of cocaine.
The murder biker gang, that just killed a guy for him essentially is like, how about you give us a half price discount?
Yeah. And he's like, you lovable scamps. Yeah. This one's on the house.
Oh, so funny.
And then as he pulls away, so the driver's like, what do you mean on the house? He's like, repeat customers.
I'll get him next time.
And what he's saying is, well, they're a murderer.
We'll overcharge him next time.
Biker gang syndicate. They do they deal drugs all the time. Like, yeah, they'll be back. So,
yeah, exactly.
So no character development, no oeuvre to his arc whatsoever. Yeah,
because
yeah,
it seems like it was important for it to be, oh, this is a character. Because it's apparently a series of books, I think. So it's somebody got this in as like, oh, we'll establish this is a character and either it could be a spinoff or something. I don't know. But anyway, that's our movie. That was fun. Good times.
Yeah.
I mean, it really was among the more enjoyable movies we've been subject to, I think, for me. I enjoyed parts about it. I got to see Marissa Tomei, which is always nice.
Yeah, and she, boy, she, her random walk-on cameos, the one in the courtroom, she's like really Marissa Tomei-ing it up. She looks good.
So great. I just like her.
And let's be clear, like in addition to being sexy in that, like she's a tremendous actor. Like she's really
she's
good.
Great.
So,
yeah. Yeah, that's our show. Thanks, patrons. Yeah. We got pretty much caught up on a lot awful movies. Here we go.
Yeah, woo.
We'll have to make sure not to fall behind next time. We'll manage, but it's hard with these live shows, you know. It's a lot to do, but we got to keep up. We'll do it. Thanks for listening. Any final thoughts, Andrew Torres?
Yeah, this had a couple medium. It didn't have any high points. It had a couple medium points. It had a couple things that I liked, and it had that great like combination of Double Jeopardy plus The Firm twist.
So bad. Why do people think attorney-client privilege is a magical spell from the Matrix or whatever, where your mouth gets erased? Like, come on.
I cannot. I long for the naive days when we started Lot Awful Movies, when I thought Hillary Clinton would be president, and I thought, there's no way we're going to find a movie with a worse premise than The Firm.
Yep. How wrong you were.
How wrong we were. So thanks for sticking around to the end with us. Hope you had a lot of fun with us. We certainly enjoyed tackling the Lincoln Lawyer.
See you next time.